dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. A political prisoner is someone jailed for their political beliefs or actions in opposition to the government. The United States has always maintained that there are no political prisoners here, as we are all free to express our beliefs. Have you seen the American flags and God Bless America banners hanging from the overpasses, remaining in place indefinitely, unmolested by police? In contrast, people who hang anti-war banners and other material expressing anti-government sentiments are arrested, sometimes handled brutally by the police, and the banners are immediately removed. There have also been numerous cases of groups of people standing in parks who were rounded up and arrested en masse because police believed they intended to engage in anti-war or anti-corporate globalization demonstrations. All such people are, in fact, political prisoners, singled out for the political content of their activities, and often given excessive sentences in order to intimidate others. Tonight we're going to hear from and about some of the current crop of political prisoners and those being targeted for punishment due to their political actions. They include four local teenagers, an elderly nun, and an anarchist webmaster. What they have in common are active opposition to the plans of the American ruling class to maximize profits by any means necessary. If you heard last week's talk on this program by career Army officer Major Doug Rocky, you will recall that he provided quite a bit of information that illustrated the lack of concern at the highest levels for the well-being of American war veterans and their families. Rocky also made clear that the plan to invade Iraq was on the table before Bush came into office. The push for what is euphemistically called free trade has been a bipartisan effort driven by the bottom lines of big business. When a middle-aged career Army officer, an elderly nun, and a young anarchist webmaster all agree on that, it's time for Americans to wake up and notice what is already obvious to most of the rest of the planet. The following article appeared in the London Independent on August 3rd, filed by Andrew Gumbel in Los Angeles. It's titled, U.S. Anti-War Activists Hit by Secret Airport Ban. Gumbel wrote, after more than a year of complaints by some U.S. anti-war activists that they were being unfairly targeted by airport security, Washington has admitted the existence of a list, possibly hundreds or even thousands of names long, of people it deems worthy of special scrutiny at airports. The list had been kept secret until its disclosure last week by the new U.S. agency in charge of aviation safety, the Transportation Security Administration, TSA. And it is entirely separate from the relatively well-publicized no-fly list, which covers about 1,000 people believed to have criminal or terrorist ties that could endanger the safety of their fellow passengers. The strong suspicion of such groups as the American Civil Liberties Union, which is suing the government to try to learn more, is that the second list has been used to target political activists who challenge the government in entirely legal ways. The TSA acknowledged the existence of the list in response to a Freedom of Information Act request concerning two anti-war activists from San Francisco who were stopped and briefly detained at the airport last autumn and told they were on an FBI no-fly list. The activists, Rebecca Gordon and Jan Adams, work for a small pacifist magazine called War Times, and say they have never been arrested, let alone have criminal records. Others who have filed complaints with the ACLU include a left-wing constitutional lawyer who has been strip-searched repeatedly when traveling through U.S. airports, and that's Barbara Olshansky of the Center for Constitutional Rights, by the way, and a 71-year-old nun from Milwaukee who was prevented from flying to Washington to join an anti-government protest. It's impossible to know for sure who might be on the list or why. The ACLU says a list kept by security personnel at Oakland Airport ran to 88 pages. More than 300 people have been subject to special questioning at San Francisco Airport, and another 24 at Oakland, according to police records. In no case does it appear that a wanted criminal was apprehended. The ACLU's senior lawyer on the case, Jayashree Srikantia, said she is troubled by several answers that the TSA gave her to her questions. The agency, she said, had no way of making sure that people did not end up on the list simply because of things they had said or organizations they belonged to. Once people were on the list, there was no procedure for trying to get off it. The TSA did not even think it was important to keep track of people singled out in error for a security grilling. According to documents the agency released, it saw, quote, no pressing need to do so, unquote. It's not just left-wingers who feel unfairly targeted. Right-wing civil libertarians have spoken out against the secret list, and at least one conservative organization, the Eagle Forum, says its members have been interrogated by security staff. The complaints by the ACLU form part of a pattern of protest since the September 11th attacks, with the Bush administration repeatedly under fire for detaining people on the flimsiest of grounds in the name of the War on Terror. Many Muslims have had a hard time, especially if they have a surname such as Hussein. And that was U.S. Anti-War Activist Hit by Secret Airport Ban, published August 3, 2003, in the London Independent, written by Andrew Gumbel. We'll begin our look at America's political prisoners close to home with a report on the trial of four teenage peace activists who were among 13 people arrested at an anti-war die-in at the Military Recruiting Center in Lansing, New York, last December 21st. The other nine demonstrators, all over 18, were tried last May. The four young women who were ages 16 through 17 at the time of their arrest are being tried as juveniles in separate proceedings. The case was set to be heard on July 23rd, but was abruptly postponed when supporters attending the trial refused the judge's orders to close the proceedings to the public.
They're asking us to leave because we're not parents or guardians, and I feel it's a huge travesty of justice.
That was the general sentiment of scores of supporters who'd been invited to witness the trial of four teenage activists. As the trial commenced last Tuesday in Lansing Town Court, Assistant District Attorney Javon Garrett approached the bench to ask Judge William Byrne to clear the packed courtroom of all but parents or guardians in order to, he said, protect the privacy of the young defendants. Family members believe the Tompkins County DA's office, headed by George Dentes, a Republican, wants to silence dissent. Linda Holzbauer, mother of defendant Anna Ritter.
The DA, who seems to get great glee out of prosecuting people who are performing civil resistance, went up and asked the judge to clear the courtroom because this was a trial of youthful offenders, and that they didn't have the right to have anybody in the courtroom to preserve their privacy. And of course their names have been in the journal many times. I mean, you know, there's no privacy here, really. And the young people who were on trial wanted their friends, family, supporters. The judge made the decision that only parents or guardians could be in the courtroom. And the D FDA claimed that the girls had waived their right to an adult trial, which they had actually made a motion to be tried with their companions in the adult trial. But luckily, Joni Brandon, who is helping with counsel for the girls, jumped up and said that that absolutely was not true, that the girls had filed a motion asking to be part of the adult trial, and that was denied. So it was an outright lie, Javon Garrett.
The teens have been charged with a misdemeanor, which would have entitled them to a jury if they had been allowed to stand trial as adults. But interestingly, the adults who participated in the same protest were charged only with violations, lesser charges that put them below the threshold allowing them trial by jury in a county where anti-war sentiment runs high. All 9 adults were convicted in a judge-only proceeding. Further, defense attorney Joni Brandon told family members that prosecutors had argued for the heavier charge against the teens because they believed that the young people had not been getting proper supervision from their parents, and that a misdemeanor charge would allow the judge to sentence them to probation where their actions could be closely regulated. Parents of the defendants considered this an attack on their family's values. The 4 teens all come from families with a long history of anti-war and social justice activism. Teresa Grady, grandmother of 3 of the activists who are cousins, is clear that her granddaughters know their own minds.
Well, they were motivated by all kinds of things through their lives. They're very young, but they've been sort of paying attention. And I know Una was telling us the other night that she was very motivated by the formation of the World Court and the statement that they made, and she read it to us and pinned it on her wall for several years now. She's been dedicated to that.
Supporters who came to witness the trial suddenly found themselves having to make some unexpected choices when the judge granted the DA's request to have the courtroom cleared.
You arrest us for trespass if we stay. Does anybody want to stay? I'm going to stay.
A few dozen decided to remain.
I'm urging people to come in this courtroom and be witnesses to what justice goes on here. And if they want to, they can arrest us all, and what a story that will be for the community. Already these young people have been denied a jury. They're now being denied the community to witness what is going on here. We can't sit down with our bodies and make them deal with the next step, not go along with each step.
The prosecutor then threatened to single out a few of the spectators and jail them on contempt of court charges. They remained nonetheless. Here's what a few of the participants in the impromptu civil disobedience had to say.
I thought I was coming to support some of my friends and neighbors, and now it seems that the idea of justice has just been chased out. The community of support, the large extended family of the 4 youthful defendants, not allowed to be here to let them know that we care and love them. Yeah, I wasn't planning on this, but you know, it just seemed so outrageous. And the judge, the way he stomped out of here, it was almost like he was about to have a tantrum. Didn't respond to any questions, and it's a bizarre situation.
I consider myself a guardian. I don't have children. I feed these children. I am confidants of these children. They come to my house. I kiss them. I love them as if they're my own. And I'm here to support their decision about standing up. And if the judge feels that my guardianship is not official enough for him, then I'm prepared to get arrested for it and to support them.
I just came to observe the hearing or trial, whatever it was, but since this judge appears to me to be quite unreasonable, and I have never been, and I've been to many trials, but I've never been in a trial where the judge cleared the courtroom and wouldn't allow the public in. So I decided, well, I'm a guardian of these young people. You know, I think we all are, and that's why I'm here. I just don't understand why we have to leave, and I don't think we should leave. So here we are. The reason why they were arrested is because they were doing the right thing. They were doing the thing that everybody should be doing, all the American people should be doing. Everybody should be out. We should all be out in the streets because this government, the Bush administration, is immoral, illegal, unethical, vicious, violent, and genocidal. They're insane. So we should all be speaking up about how insane our government is.
I think I'll just sit here and watch the trial. It's an American right. The girls have waived their right to privacy, and so it's really not about protecting them. It's about clearing the courtroom of friends and supporters who approve of what they did. It's clear that the United States has falsified things to such an extent, which is a terrible thing for the greatest world power to be telling lies. And the effort to keep people from knowing these things and paying attention, even on the local level, to small efforts to close us off from the truth has to be resisted.
No arrests were made, and the judge ordered the trial postponed. Supporters flooded back into the empty courtroom to join hands and sing. The trial is rescheduled for Tuesday, September 2nd at 10:30 a.m. at the town of Lansing Court. The young people and their families are once again requesting members of the community to attend. Thanks to Daniel Burns of the Catholic Worker Hour for the audio material used in this report. This is Lynn Gary reporting for the Ithaca Radio Hour. Sherman Austin is a Los Angeles-based political activist who maintains a website with material oriented towards anarchist politics, RaiseTheFists.com. On August 4th, he was sentenced to 1 year in federal prison for hosting a website that contained links to information about bomb-making. Although information on how to make bombs is commonly available in libraries, universities, and on the Internet, the U.S. Justice Department charged Austin under a law that had been sponsored by Senator Dianne Feinstein, a Democrat of California, that prohibits, quote, distribution of information relating to explosives, destructive devices, and weapons of mass destruction with the intent that such information be used in furtherance of a federal crime of violence, close quote. U.S. District Judge Stephen Wilson sentenced Austin to triple the sentence the prosecutor had recommended under a binding plea bargain agreement. Austin was also given a $2,000 fine and 3 years of probation. He faces strict restrictions and monitoring of his use of computers, and a prohibition from associating with any person or group that, quote, espouses violence or physical force as means of intimidation or achieving economic, social, or political change, close quote. Internet free speech advocates such as the Electronic Frontier Foundation and the Online Policy Group condemned the sentencing. Last week, days after his sentencing, Sherman Austin and his friends Chantel and Lupe spoke with Agitdrop on killradio.org in Los Angeles. We bring you that interview.
Many of us who heard about and read about the sentencing that went down on Monday were just completely shocked and infuriated by what happened in your sentencing, and you've got a one-year sentence in a federal prison for the information that was published on a website that you had something to do with or started called RaiseTheFist.com. And so for our listeners, maybe we can start off with some background about Raise the Fist and the history and where this all started, then we can get into some of the details about where this is going. And
I started the website on President's Day of 2001. Since then, the site's just grown and it's developed, and throughout time it just got more and more popular, and more people started knowing about it and using the website. And even long before the raid, you know, government agencies and the FBI and even international government agencies, you know, monitor the site daily. And as the site just got more and more popular, as time went on, it just kept coming back more and more and more.
Right.
And basically, it just got to a point where I guess they saw the site as more than just a site, but a resource and a tool that was used for, you know, communication, networking, organizing, things like that. And I suppose it scared them because it was just basically effective. It was something that was, you know, being used as a tool that benefited people. On January 24th of 2002, just a few months after the new U.S. Patriot Act was passed, about 25 federal agents from the FBI, the Secret Service, and the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department, and some officers from the LAPD came to my house. I was sleeping at the time. It was about 4 p.m. I was taking a nap. I didn't know at the time they had my house surrounded with weapons drawn. They had machine guns, you know, shotguns. They had every angle of the house they had covered. They had it completely surrounded. And my sister was leaving at the time with her friend, and she noticed a bunch of FBI-looking cars and, you know, government-looking people parked all up and down the street. And she looked at them, and they were all pointing at the house, so she knew something wasn't right. So she basically ran back inside and told me what was up, woke me up, told me what was up. So I got up, and I checked the lights on my router, and I noticed that my whole DSL connection was down, because I was actually hosting the website from my room, from a basic DSL connection on a little computer network I had set up. And I noticed the site was down, so I knew right then and there that the FBI was out, you know, obviously coming to shut down the site. And, you know, what else they were doing, I wasn't really sure. So I got up, I went to the door, and there was two federal agents who came to the door. So I opened the door, and I asked them what their problem was, and they asked me if my name was Sherman Austin, and I said, yeah. And they said, come outside, and I said, why? And they just said, come outside again. And they pulled me outside, and right then and there I saw a bunch of guys from the FBI and Secret Service. They were all on my in the front of the house with guns. I saw guys coming out from the side of the house with guns, you know, from every side of the house. I can't remember what happened. I think they said, do you know why we're here? I said, yeah, it's obviously my website, raisethefist.com. You guys have been on it, you know, every single day. They showed me a 25-page warrant, and I just, like, skimmed through it, and I was like, you know, what is this? What is this all about? So basically, we went back inside, and they tried to question me, but I was, you know, looking through the warrant, and I was just, the stuff they had on the warrant was just, you know, completely bogus. They just took a bunch of different things and twisted them all around and, you know, made up, you know, false information just to make it look like, you know, like they were raiding like a real terrorist or someone who was, like, part of some, like, you know, armed militia or something like that.
How old were you at the time this went down?
I was 18. Yeah, I mean, when they came, I mean, they came, they didn't come, you know, all nice and peaceful and everything, you know, knocking at the door like, hi, is your name Sherman Austin, blah, blah, blah. I mean, they came with bulletproof vests, guns. I mean, they came ready for, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, they came, you know, ready to kill. They came ready for, you know, a battle all over, all because of a website. They tried to interrogate me for about 4 or 5 hours during the time a lot of the other agents were in my room dismantling the computer network and bringing each computer out one by one and hooking it up to their portable equipment. What they were doing was mirroring each hard drive and downloading the information off each hard drive onto their own portable equipment, and then taking each computer, boxing it up, and then loading it into this big white truck that was parked on the side of my house. And during that time, I was asked questions. Like, the Secret Service asked me a question, like, if I'd like to see the president killed. And I said no, and he kept, like, persisting the question. He kept trying to, like, change the question, trying to get me to say yes. And, like, he looked at me all seriously, and I was just like, I mean, I looked at him, and I laughed, and I was like, no, like, what's your problem? Like, it's just amazing, like, the way they came, like, I mean, either they seriously thought, like, I was some kind of terrorist, or they knew I wasn't a terrorist. They knew about the website, but they just wanted to come, take all the servers, shut it down, and I guess get information off my servers and get logs and things like that. I don't know, but they're obviously, you know, pretty serious about the whole thing. After that, after about 4 or 5 hours, they left. Oh, I forgot to mention, they also took a lot of political literature and some protest signs, too. I had, like, a big stack of, like, political literature just sitting in my room. And they just took, like, the entire thing, just put it in a box, along with some protest signs and stuff, and just put that in the box, too. And you just pretty much loaded everything up into a big white truck. And then they basically left. The raid started about, like, 4 p.m., and they left around 11 p.m., I think. And
they didn't take you into custody at that time?
No, they didn't take me into custody at all. They said, you're not going to be arrested. They even said I could leave right then and there. They said, like, you're free to go. Like, you can, you know, leave and come back, do whatever you want. But, you know, I just stuck around. And they told me, like, at least, like, 4 or 5 times, like, you're not being arrested. You know, this is just a raid. We just want to get those computers and see what's on them, you know, and stuff like that. So, I mean, basically, I mean, that's what they did. And they just completely took all the computers, loaded them up, and, you know, pretty much took them away.
Now, was this before the Long Beach incident?
No, this was after the Long Beach incident. This was, May Day.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, which Long Beach incident?
Yeah, there's several.
The May Day Long Beach.
It was after Long Beach. May Day 2001.
May Day 2001, yeah. Yeah, which was interesting because after May Day 2001, I noticed a big increase in government, you know, hits on my website. I mean, right after I got out of jail, 3 days, I got arrested at May Day and I spent 3 days in jail. And right after I got out, I looked at my logs and there was so many more hits from government agencies coming on there than what there was prior to May Day.
Right.
And I think it was because I had some Raise the Fist flyers in my backpack. And apparently, from what I heard, the FBI seized all the evidence from May Day and it looked through everything. And I guess once they saw that, I guess they started coming to the site more. So basically, yeah, that happened. Should I talk about May Day at all? Or?
Sure, if you want to. Yeah, give people some background on what happened there.
Sure, yeah. Well, it was May 1st, 2001. I basically went there to videotape. You know, I didn't really come expecting any type of, violent police attack. I just came pretty chill. I came with, sandals, just wore some jeans, t-shirt, and just came with my video camera. I just wanted to see what was going on. And when I got there, I noticed a lot of cops all up and down streets. I mean, they had the whole area swarming with police officers. And I got there, and we were in the promenade in downtown Long Beach. And it was like, the promenade is like kind of a little bit divided on one side of a street where buses come through. Is where we were, where everyone had been assembled. And on the other side of the street, they had about like 50 cops with, riot gear just standing there and videotaping us. And they were just across the street. And we were on the other side of the street. And they had some other cops, driving around, riding their bicycles around, and stuff like that. So basically, people were assembled there for a while. And then we just got up and we just tried to, march very peacefully. We marched down the street one way, and the police immediately cut us off. So we just turned around and started marching the other way. And then they cut us off again, and they started taking out their batons. Like 2 minutes into the march, they were already swinging their batons, already starting to hit people and already getting violent. And we were just marching. Nothing happened. I mean, I even had the whole incident on videotape. I mean, we barely even got to chant and they were already swinging their batons at us. I mean, but despite that, we kept marching. And we marched down one street and then they blocked us off again. And this time I remember seeing them swing their batons and even more. I remember seeing one officer who was about, like, this one really big officer who was like, I mean, he was pretty big. And this one smaller girl was just saying something to him, and he just took his baton and just jabbed it right into her stomach. I mean, for no reason at all. I mean, she didn't even do anything. I mean, it was just absolutely there's nowhere to describe it really. But after that, like they had blocked us off so we couldn't go a certain way, so we just turned around and went back up the street, and then they had cops. By this time, they had cops behind us, cops in front of us, cops all around us. And then we got to another intersection, and then they blocked us off again and made us go another way. And, like, by this time, it was pretty obvious that they were, they had already, set up a planned destination where they wanted us to, go through. It seemed like they were luring us into this trap where they can corner us in and, arrest us all. And that's pretty much what happened. We were marching down Ocean Street, and then we stopped kind of, like, in the middle of the street. And the police were just standing there, and by this time they were getting, really violent. I mean, they were just swinging their batons like crazy. I remember one girl who was there, she wasn't even part of, like, the protest, really. She wasn't even an anarchist. She was just there watching what was going on and, just decided to march. And she told one of the cops something. I think she said that you guys are being, like, very, like, brutal and stuff, and she decided to leave. And as she turned her back to walk away, this one cop, this one, really big guy, just took this big power swing into her back with his baton. For, like, no reason at all. And, like, that was just, like, I mean, I had that on videotape, too, which is, the unfortunate thing about that is the cops, when I was arrested, the cops took my camera, and they got the film, and they erased it all. And when that happened, the cops, I remember one guy who was pretty much, controlling the police officers. Every time the police would come forward and swing at us, he would pull them back and be like, all right, let them walk a little bit more, as if he was trying to get us to come to a certain spot. That eventually kept happening until out of the corner of my eye, I saw a lot of other police officers from SWAT, and they just ran right up behind me, and they just assembled a firing line, and they just opened fire on us, like, immediately. And they had, like, geez, they had a lot of cops shooting at us from, like, they had us all, like, surrounded, and they were just shooting at us. So we had, like, nowhere to go. So we just ran towards this one building, which was a retirement home, and we were just basically cornered in. At that point, they still had their guns pointing at us, and people were just on the ground, you know, holding up their hands. People were, you know, against the building, you know, holding up their hands, and they still had their guns pointing at us. At that time, I didn't realize how severely I was shot. I just know I had been hit, like, 2 times, but I didn't know that, like, I had, like, penetrating wounds in my calf. Not until I looked at the police station. For some reason, I was, like, one of the first people arrested. I think it was because I was videotaping. Immediately after they shot us, one of the cops pointed me out and told me to come forward, and I said, you know, I'm just taking pictures, I'm just videotaping here. And then he swung me around and threw me to the ground, and about 3 officers, you know, pounced on me and arrested me. And then they just basically took us down to the Long Beach Police Station. And I was sitting there, and I didn't notice how severely I was shot until there was, like, a pool of blood coming from underneath my leg. And one of the cops looked at it, and then he lifted up my pants to see my leg, and he saw, like, there was, like, because what they shot me with was, like, a 12-gauge shotgun loaded with those scattershot projectiles, those plastic shells that are just scattershots. And all the scattershots went into my leg, and there was about, like, 14 different scatter wounds all penetrating into my calf. And even the cap of the shell was in there. So it looked pretty bad. So then I went to the hospital, and I got all the pieces removed from my leg except for one piece, which is still in my leg, which is part of the shell. It's still in there right now. And after that, they took us down to the police station. And I remember when we got to the police station, I was there with another person. His name is Jeff. He had his arm fractured by a baton. And we were just sitting there waiting for them to take us to Twin Towers. And one of the cops walked past us, and he said to Jeff, like, what happened to your arm? And he said, I was just at a protest, and the cops hit it with a baton, and they broke it. And the cop just looked at him, and he was like, come back in, and we'll break the other one. And he just walked away. And then after that, they just drove us to Twin Towers. And I sat there with my leg, like, in bandages that were, like, soaked in blood for about 13 hours until a doctor just checked it and just pretty much replaced the bandages. And I was in county jail for about 3 days. And then I was released. I was one of the last people released because I wasn't bailed out at all. I was released, and after that, there was meetings and stuff like that, and there was supposed to be a lot of court solidarity, but I guess all that broke down, and mostly everyone decided to cop pleas, because at first they were charging us with 6 misdemeanor counts, and they offered us plea bargains to plead to, I think, only failure to disperse with 1 year informal summary probation.
I just want to remind listeners that we're in studio with Sherman Austin talking about the unprecedented sentence of somebody who is hosting a website, and the information surrounding that was on that website, sentenced 1 year to a federal prison for this. This is the May Day demonstration of 2001 you're talking about, and this is prior to the raid at your house where they took all your computers, and in response to, well, RaiseTheFist.com.
When you know, everyone was handling their court cases and everything like that, you know, people just started pleading, but I still wanted to go to trial. Like, I was like, I mean, I'm definitely going to trial on this. Like, this is complete BS. Like, they shot me, and all I was doing was videotaping, and I have this permanent physical damage done to my leg, and for what? I mean, for nothing. And then during this time, I mean, this thing was just so drawn out that while I was in the process of, you know, going back and forth to court all the time, playing this legal limbo with them, January 24th came up, and my house was raided by the FBI. And at this point, nothing had happened with Mayday yet. I haven't been convicted or anything like that yet. And so then my house got raided, and that happened. After the raid on my house, despite what had happened, I still continued with my plans to attend the World Economic Forum protests in New York City. So I drove to New York City, and I went there, and at first the FBI thought I wasn't going, but I guess once they found out I was going, from what I heard, the FBI and Secret Service notified the New York police chief and told them that I was going to be there. And I was just basically standing in Columbus Circle, you know, just, you know, minding my own business, waiting to begin the march. And out of nowhere, like 20 police officers just completely, like, rush us. And they just like, scoop up about 26 of us, and I was one of those 26. And they just take us on a bus, and we're on a bus for like 7 hours, and they take us to Brooklyn Navy Yard Jail, where they had us, and I was there for about 30 hours, and then I was taken into a back room in handcuffs and interrogated again by someone from the Secret Service and someone from the FBI. And then when I was interrogated there, I mean, they asked me questions like if I was, like, involved in any terrorist organizations, if I was a terrorist, if I had come to New York with anyone else. They kept bringing up the raid on my house. I refused to, you know, talk about any of that. But they kept asking questions over and over, even though I told them, no, I'm not talking about it, trying to get, you know, different answers out of me. So I just said no. And then they told me how I got to New York. And stupid of me, I told them I drove my car. So then they thought I had brought bombs with me and my car. So then they told me, you're not going to leave New York until we get to search your car. And I was like, why? I have nothing in my car. And then they said, you know, we can keep you here as long as we want. You're not going to leave until we search your car. So I was like, you know what, forget this. Like, I have nothing to hide. Like, there's nothing illegal in my car. So I just signed over the keys and I said, here, search my car. I don't know exactly where it is, but I described the area to them. And, you know, I said, you know, I have absolutely nothing to hide. You can't keep me here without charging me. If you do, you know, I'm going to have a major lawsuit against you guys. You know, he just basically laughed at me. And I was like, I told him something like, you know, I just came here to basically try and exercise my so-called freedom of speech, and now I'm here being interrogated, being treated like I'm a terrorist. And they said something like, well, that's your problem. And I was like, yeah, only in fascist America, right? And he's like, yeah. And then they just led me back out. And 5 minutes later, which was the interesting thing, 5 minutes later, I was released, and I was taken to the courthouse, and I was just basically, you know, released. I wasn't even in custody anymore. And that, I mean, they had just left, and then I had just been released, which was weird. And when that happened, I was just basically, I made a phone call for someone to pick me up, and I was waiting around for about 30 minutes until about 4 or 5 FBI agents came to the courthouse, and they arrested me, and they said I was being arrested for distribution of information related to explosives over the internet. And then I was like, you know, why am I being arrested? Why wasn't I arrested in California? And I tried, you know, I tried to yell to the legal people that I was being arrested again, and they're like, shut the F up, and they just rushed me out the door and grabbed me by my neck and just herded me into this black SUV. And then they drove me to this federal building, and then they tried to question me again, but I was just like, you know, at that point I was just like completely defiant. I was like, why wasn't I arrested in California? Like, this is complete BS. And then they're just like, you know, forget it. So they just took me to the lower Manhattan federal jail facility, and they put me in maximum security 24-hour lockdown. And I was there for the night, and then the next day I had an arraignment, which was postponed because my lawyer, Susan Tipograph, wanted to go through all the stuff, the arrest affidavit, and see exactly what was going on before we had proceeded with the court hearings and things like that. So it was postponed, and then we eventually had a bail hearing. And at the bail hearing, they denied me bail because they said I was a threat to the community. The FBI said I drove 3,000 miles to New York to carry out my alleged plot to blow things up, and on the way back I was going to stop off at Salt Lake City and then, like, blow up the Olympics. And they said I was a man on a mission, and that, you know, I was basically a terrorist. And he was accusing me of, like, all this, like, bogus stuff, and, like, they were just building up this case to make it look like they were pretty much justified in doing what they did.
Can I just jump in there real quick? And also, while he was in jail, there were people signing on and off of his instant messenger.
Oh, yeah.
And we're his friends. We're talking with his family and his attorney the whole time, and his various, like, IM names, there's people logging on and off pretending to be him. If they're not pretending to be him, they're threatening other people that are trying to instant message him. And so we knew, like, this was happening before he even got arrested, before the raid, but it intensified extremely while he was in jail. Like, on a regular basis, 12 times a day, there was various people, like, logging on to all of his IM names.
So, just to clarify, they were stealing your IM names somehow.
They had passwords.
Oh, they had passwords.
And they had, at one point, one of our friends in San Diego, James, I know he tried IMing them, and the only message he got back was, you're next. And that was
Who do you suspect was IMing?
It was the cops.
Yeah.
Who else could it be?
No. I expect it was people working for the FBI. I mean, because this started happening a few months before the raid. I had found out that they had begun packeting my DSL line. What that is basically is that they monitor all incoming and outgoing, data going through my internet connection. And I had found this out like a few months before the raid, and they were doing this for a while. And then they started coming onto my instant messenger accounts and into my email accounts, and they started locking me out, and they started commandering those accounts and started talking to people. And it was obvious that they were packaging me, because when they would IM people, they would use the same words I used. They would talk the same way like I would talk. I mean, you can tell that they were paying very close attention to my conversations and the way I would communicate with people. And they would try to, pretty much like impersonate me and try to act like as if they were me, and they would IM people. And, various people I talked to actually thought it was me, because, I mean, they talk just like me. I mean, they had been monitoring me for a while, and they had paid very close attention to the way, I said things online, and they just... Okay.
So just to be clear, this was after they seized the computers at your house.
They started doing this before they seized the computers.
So somehow they were able to get a hold of passwords for your instant messenger names prior to coming to your house and taking your computers.
Yeah. I remember talking to Sherman, like a fake Sherman, and then about just randomly like some event going on or a show. And then I would actually talk to him like the next day. And it was like I didn't talk to him because he didn't know what I was talking about, because it wasn't him that I had talked to the day before. And we just became used to it, like the people that talked to him regularly. So we started like playing these. I remember like we would play like these silly games, like ask questions to each other about things that we would only know back and forth, because it became funny at one point, just because it was happening repeatedly. And then it was horrible yet funny at the same time that they were doing it while he was in jail, like we didn't know. And we know he's in jail, and his name is just popping on and off and on and off, like instant messenger. So
we're talking to Sherman Austin about the recent court decision to send him to prison for 1 year, starting September 1st, right?
Third.
September 3rd. Sherman, so after you got arrested after being in New York, that's when the charges came down. And so maybe bring us up to the present after that time.
Actually, the prosecution, they decided not to indict me. And then it was 6 months later when the charges came back. During those 6 months, I had the website up, and I was pretty much, just going back to what I was doing, continuing my political work within the community, and I was, working on Race of Fists. And that site developed a lot since then. It grew. A lot more people started knowing about it and coming to the website. And it developed more into of a direct action network with, different chapters in different areas, not just around the U.S., but around the world, of different organizations and affinity groups and, just groups of people. So it wasn't just a website anymore. It was an actual direct action network that could be used to organize and coordinate events and different types of actions with a capacity that we can do this type of thing in different areas around the U.S. and around the world. So overall, it just became more of a resource and more of a tool. So then 6 months later, the prosecutors contacted my lawyer, and they told them they didn't really find anything on my computers to get me for, but they didn't want to let me off the hook. So what they proceeded to do was offer me a pre-indictment binding plea, which was offer me a plea bargain without indicting me, like before indicting me, offer me a plea bargain. And what that was 1 month in jail and 5 months in a halfway house in community confinement. And at first I rejected it. I wanted to go to trial because at first I wanted them, if they were going to bring anything against me, why couldn't they indict me? Why couldn't they just go through the procedure as normal? I was assuming because they wanted to keep it pretty quiet, keep it under the table so there wasn't going to be that much media attention about it and just get it over with and get their conviction. So at first I wanted to go to trial. My lawyer told me that, if I wanted to go to trial, the choice is, pretty much up to me. At that point, we didn't realize how severe the case was. So I can't remember what happened next, but... Oh, yeah, that's right. I wanted to go to trial, but then the prosecutors kept trying to get me to take the plea. I went to court for an arraignment, and I officially, rejected the plea. And after that happened, the prosecutors still left it open. They still, urged me, to take the plea bargain. So then I was like, you know, what is this all about? Like, what is it that they really have on me? I want to see what they have on me. So we requested a meeting with the two prosecutors, my lawyer, me, and my mom, just to basically see what they had, what they were intending to use against me if I were to take this thing to trial. And it was basically a meeting where I just stayed mute, and they just talked and said what they had. And it was kind of funny because the supervisor prosecutor, the guy who was pretty much in charge of whether or not I was going to be indicted or not, it was funny because he was trying to come off like back in the days he used to be involved in like in protests. I can't remember exactly which organization he was involved with. He was involved and, you know, cops would come and beat them down, and that, you know, he was trying to like legitimize himself and like try to make it look like he's there on the same page too. When I just thought, you know, this guy's a complete sellout. You know, at one point he's talking about, yeah, protesting, doing, you know, progressive work in the community. Next moment, you know, he's prosecuting someone who would have been, you know, right there standing next to him doing the same work he was doing. So they were just talking to me. They just showed me these pictures of what they say was like a Molotov cocktail, which was complete BS, which I thought. And they showed me, they pretty much admitted to packeting my line because they had said that they had been monitoring my AOL Instant Messenger conversations, that they didn't have logs that they had seized from my computers, but they were actually monitoring the conversations. They would reference to certain conversations I was having online. They were like, well, we have this and this, and we have this and this. And so it was, I mean, they pretty much admitted in saying that, like, they had been monitoring my internet activity. I shouldn't really go to trial because I could be facing, you know, 2 to 3 years in prison, and that I should take a plea because I didn't want to go to prison, and this isn't something I wanted to risk over. So after that, I still wanted to go to the trial, but they were still urging me to take the plea. So, I mean, there was some, like, legal limbo going back and forth. Like, at one point I decided, you know, just forget it. I'll just take the plea and get this over with. 1 month in jail, you know, 5 months community confinement compared to, like, 3 years, whatever. I just want to get this thing over with. It's been so long drawn out by now. But then I decided, you know, screw this. Like, I want to go to a trial. So it was just, like, back and forth. Like, I couldn't really decide what I wanted to do. So then after that for a while, we found out that a terrorism enhancement was applicable to what I was being charged with. And what that was something that, it's based on the judge's decision to add an additional 20 years to my sentence. That was pretty much used to, like, try and get me to get me into taking a plea so I wouldn't take this to trial. I mean, it was funny because this wasn't brought up until I wanted to go to trial, until, like, I kept refusing their plea bargain. So after that, I was like, you know, if it's going to be 20 years, I might as well just take a plea. 1 month in jail versus 20 years. I wasn't in the mood for martyring myself or anything like that. I just wanted to, you know, get this thing over with. So we went to court to enter the plea bargain before the judge. And, you know, basically, I was supposed to, you know, he was supposed to accept it that day. And, you know, everything was going to move on. But the
judge... This is Judge Wilson.
Yeah, Judge Stephen V. Wilson. We went to court and the judge, like, immediately was, like, against the plea. He said that anyone who posts information to the website, anyone who posts any type of information related to explosives to the internet should serve at least 12 months in prison. And he was just going off about, like, this doesn't buy him, like, a free ticket. Like, just because he's young doesn't buy him a free ticket. I couldn't remember exactly what he said, but we're going to be ordering the transcripts of that hearing.
You know, isn't there a number of people on the internet who publish this type of information?
Yeah, I mean, you can find this type of information anywhere. I mean, the stuff that was on Raise the Fist, which was actually linked to another site which was hosted by Raise the Fist, the information on there was just like, I mean, you could find 10 times more information on any other website. You can go to, I mean, there's thousands of websites out there where you can find information on how to build explosives, how to use explosives. I mean, you can go to howthingswork.com and type in the keyword explosives, and you can find out how to make everything from dynamite to grenades to, you know, high-powered explosives. I mean, if someone wanted to really make explosives and use them for, you know, something illegal, they wouldn't rely on raisethefist.com. They would go to a website where that information is much more readily available and much more detailed.
Also, the information, not only is it readily available, but by the way they went about going after Sherman is more proof that they specifically wanted him and the website down, because, like he said, it was hosted, he was just hosting a website for someone else. The FBI has interrogated this person, has talked to them, and he hasn't had one charge brought against him. And it was his website that was holding all of this information. All he had was basically a link from his site to that site, which had all that information. But he hasn't been touched, basically. And we're friends with that guy, so it's not to say like it was his fault, because or that we want him to get screwed over in this process either. But like, the fact remains that Sherman is a young black male growing up in this country, and this boy was a white guy growing up in Orange County with like really rich parents who probably would have not let him be touched, you know? And the FBI interrogated him, and he voluntarily spoke to them. Sherman's the one that went down for this. Specifically, that brings it around more to it being about the specific site. And by the FBI's own admittance, they've been watching him since he was 13, 14 years old. They have information on him.
It's not even just about the site, it's about Sherman.
It's about Sherman, and it's about... They viewed him, in their own words, as a man on a mission. And by, like, the court's own documents that I have here, and this is the pre-sentence, and the recommendations that the prosecution actually had on him. And it says specifically, before the court is a 20-year-old male with his second criminal conviction, the first one being Mayday, the defendant is an anarchist and has been involved in a number of protests against institutions such as the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And these were justifications, one of the first justifications that's listed here on why they went after him and raided his house and are holding him liable for these allegations. They specifically wanted, if it was about the information being out there, why would they not take down, why would they not go after the person that originally posted them and put the reclaim guide up?
Absolutely.
They went after him because they wanted him down to be scared and not go after this. And second, they wanted the site down. They wanted the site shut down.
Now, it's clear that this was a politicized trial, and this was targeting, from what I've read in the papers and the reports and some of the publications, that this is about the politics. This is about you being an anarchist.
Yeah, absolutely.
And just to read a quote from the judge, Wilson said, "This should be looked at with more of a deterrence outcome to future revolutionaries wanting to act in a similar manner." And this was in court.
Yeah, he said that in court. I mean, he made it obvious that this was about politics. This wasn't about posting information related to explosives to the internet. This was about, this was specifically about persecuting someone simply because they're an anarchist.
I have some questions here that people are asking, and I'm just going to throw them out, and feel free to answer the ones that you want to answer, and don't answer the ones that you don't. One question is there any validity to the charges that you hacked and defaced websites?
No, they never provided any of that information.
Hold on a second. I'm sorry. Sherman is about the specific guilt or not guilt of specific actions. He's not allowed to, or he's advised not to speak on them, specifically because he's already signed this plea and he's been sentenced. So if it gets into dicey on the things he pled guilty or didn't plead guilty to, it can make the plea bargain valid or not valid. So that's something we don't really want to touch right now.
What about the issue of, somebody asked, was the actions considered sedition?
Were the actions considered what?
Seditious. That's a, I believe it's a legal term, which is, you know, basically means that your interests are in seditious activity to overthrow the government of the United States. Or did they ever use the word sedition?
They used, I remember in the arrest affidavit, they used, I can't remember exactly word for word, but they were making reference to the fact that the information was posted to the website with the intent that it would be used to, basically used as self-defense against, you know, police if they happen to attack demonstrators, and to be used to interrupt meetings of international and foreign commerce. In other words, interrupt, you know, World Bank meetings and IMF.
Okay. Go ahead.
Sorry, just to add to that, one of the other things, and this was really bizarre, during the time that this was going on, it was right before and, like, during the Olympics in Salt Lake City, Utah, And Sherman had posted a link on his website regarding some protests that were going to be going on in Salt Lake City in regards to all the homeless people that were kicked out of the city and picked up and dumped in the forest due to the Olympics. So he had a link on there saying, you know, go to these protests, various protests. One of the things that they used in court and accused him of the day of the raid in New York was that he, on his way back from New York to California, he was going to stop by the Olympics and try to blow it up. Those were their exact words. They're accusing him of this. And that was one of the treasonous things he was being blamed for, on top of them continuously asking him if he wanted to see the president dead or et cetera, things like that.
Okay. One other question is in court, what was the response to the fact that information is already clearly and widely distributed?
The response from the judge, or?
I'm assuming in court, what was the response by the prosecution to the fact that information is already clearly and widely distributed?
Yeah, that was actually never brought up in court.
Because it didn't go to trial.
It never went to trial.
There was, and this is not to come down on his federal public defender, but it was a huge railroading as far as they were constantly put in front of him and his family that he was facing 20 years and a $250,000 fine if he was to take this to trial and be found guilty, and he didn't have a chance. In a whole lot of different ways, this, we can sit here and say if it had gone to trial, a lot of these questions that people are asking would have come out. And one of the reasons they can't really be answered is because there wasn't a chance to go to trial, and a plea bargain had to be taken. So people can take that information and read the stuff that's online and read the different various interviews that were done before this event and find out a lot more about this case that are talked about in them.
Sherman, how do you feel about what's your feeling right now about all this?
I don't know. At some level, I'm like, I'm not really surprised about what's going on. I mean, just because I guess I've come to realize, like, that's the nature of this government. I'm not surprised that they're going to come out and, you know, basically persecute people for trying to exercise their First Amendment right. They've been doing that ever since this government was founded. We can talk about how our rights are being stripped away because of the Patriot Act. The fact is our rights have already been stripped away. The Patriot Act, I think, is just them coming out in public and saying, all right, we're going to do this, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do this, and this time we're not going to be sneaky about it. We're going to do it right in front of your face, and that way we're going to intimidate you even more than what we've been doing before. So I think that, I mean, in that sense, it's not surprising to me at all, especially based on the judge's remarks from the past hearings, that he wanted to give me at least 12 months in jail, that he wanted to set an example for future revolutionaries, that he pretty much wanted to do nothing but, you know, set an example. That was his whole purpose for giving me a 12-month sentence in prison, was to set an example.
WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio.